Welcome to the deep dive. Today we've got three, pretty dense analyses lined up. We're really going deep into the structure of Russian power, pulling threads from history right up to today's playbook.
That's the plan. We're aiming for clarity, really extracting the key insights you need. We'll cover how the Russian Orthodox Church has been, frankly, weaponized, the real challenges faced by opposition and exile, and those deep historical patterns that make Russia so, different from Europe.
It's quite a journey, isn't it? From faith to international law, then way back into history. Let's start with maybe the most striking source, how religion got tangled up with state aggression. Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah, what's really fascinating, or maybe alarming, is how the Russian Orthodox Church, the ROC, often acts less like an independent church and more
Right.
like a core part of the Kremlin's machine, almost a state department for political and information warfare.
And the key tool here, our sources say, is this doctrine of Russki Mir, the Russian world. How does Moscow actually, use that concept on the ground?
Well, it's a strategy, really. It mixes this shared Orthodox identity with a pretty aggressive form of nationalism. It lets Moscow use faith to justify its actions, its expansionist ideas. The targets are pretty clear: Ukraine, Georgia, Moldova, trying to undermine their moves toward the West, sowing doubts about NATO, the EU. But it's bigger than that now. It's reaching into Africa, parts of Europe too. The idea is to position Russia as this sort of defender of traditional values against the West.
And this isn't just talk, is it? There's a whole infrastructure behind it. You're talking about state, church, media, money, all linked up.
Exactly. It's an ecosystem. They use their global dioceses, cultural centers as sort of soft power outposts. Funding often comes via Kremlin-friendly oligarchs, and their digital stuff, like Telegram channels linked to the Moscow Patriarchate, they pump out this specific political line.
It sounds incredibly integrated.
It is. And to really get how complete this capture is, you have to look back, way back. Peter the Great, back in 1721, he abolished the Patriarchate altogether, replaced it with the Holy Governing Synod.
Making it basically a government department.
Pretty much. Bishops became state officials. It created this system of, spiritual servitude that lasted right up until the revolution.
Then there was that brief moment of hope for the church after 1917. But the Soviets soon crushed that, didn't they?
They did. First, just pure suppression. But by the late 1920s, the secret police got smarter, using both terror and co-option, getting parts of the church on their side.
And that led to something called Surgeonism.
Yes, that's absolutely critical. In 1927, Metropolitan Sergius issued this declaration of loyalty to the Soviet Union. It was a formal surrender, really, putting the spiritual leadership under the thumb of an atheist state. It basically snuffed out any real institutional independence for the ROC.
Wow.
And here's where it gets really interesting. After 1943, during and after the war, the church leadership was heavily populated with state security agents or, collaborators.
And that pattern continues right up to the present day. Our sources mention the current patriarch Kirill.
Right. There's Swiss archival evidence suggesting that Vladimir Gundiev, who is now Patriarch Kirill, might have been a KGB officer, codenamed Mikhailov, apparently, when he was stationed in Geneva in the 70s. When you talk about institutional capture, well, there it is.
It's quite startling.
And under Kirill, especially since he took over in 2009, this Russki Mir doctrine has been front and center, explicitly blessing geopolitical goals. You see it in his sermons, particularly after 2022. He calls the invasion of Ukraine a holy struggle against a decadent West.
There was that example too, blessing crosses with Putin's initials for war heroes.
Exactly. Just recently, in 2024, it's unambiguous.
And this global push is accelerating. You mentioned Africa.
Yes, since 2021, they've set up a new patriarchal exarchate in Africa, claiming hundreds of parishes across dozens of countries. Officially, it's about pastoral care, but Ukrainian intelligence calls it what it is: a hybrid influence operation, trying to push Russia's agenda, undermine Western ties.
And closer to home, in places like Georgia and Moldova.
Similar tactics. ROC-linked clergy push anti-Western narratives, painting NATO and the EU as threats to traditional Christian values. The church acts as a kind of transmission belt for Russian foreign policy messages.
The situation in Ukraine must be particularly intense given the history. The Orthodox Church of Ukraine gaining independence in 2019, that was a major break from Moscow.
A huge rupture. And since the full-scale invasion in 2022, it's become an open fight over faith and national identity. Ukraine's security service, the SBU, they've opened something like 174 criminal cases against clergy from the Moscow-linked church, the UOCMP.
What kind of charges are we talking about?
Collaboration, propaganda, over 120 priests charged, dozens convicted, and some cases are really stark, like that priest in Kherson caught trying to sell Igla missiles and explosives hidden under a church construction site.
Missiles? Wow.
Yeah. It shows the state is dealing with what it sees as active subversive networks using religion as cover.
Okay, so we've seen how institutions inside Russia can be shaped, even weaponized, by these deep state structures. Let's pivot now. What about those trying to fight this system, but from the outside? We're talking about the political immigrants from Belarus after 2020, Russia after 2022. What are their limits?
Right. And this is where it gets really tricky. Why is it so hard for an opposition in exile to gain real political legitimacy? The fundamental problem goes back centuries, really, to the idea of state sovereignty. Think Peace of Westphalia, 1648.
States have the power.
Exactly. Now, after World War II, things like the Nuremberg trials, the European Court of Human Rights, they did empower individuals more. But exile groups still can't really claim to be the nation in the way a government-controlling territory can.
History gives us some clues here, doesn't it? You contrast, say, governments in exile during WWII, like Norway's.
Right. They were kicked out by a foreign invasion. That gave them immediate legitimacy fighting an occupier. But compare that to the Russian whites. After their civil war, they lost. Why? Because the Bolshevik Reds controlled the country domestically. They weren't seen as foreign invaders. So eventually, other countries pragmatically recognized the Soviet regime, authoritarian as it was.
Domestic control is key, then.
It's decisive. Look at the Iranian opposition today. Millions live abroad, but they're split. Monarchists, the NCRI, others. Huge protests inside Iran haven't led to a unified external front that Western governments feel they can formally back. They support human rights, sure, but they don't endorse any group as a government awaiting.
Belarus seems a bit different, though. More unified around Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya based on that contested 2020 election.
Yes, that's a stronger case. She's recognized as the leader of Belarus's democratic forces. They've set up institutions like the United Transition Cabinet. And, significantly, PACE, the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, created a special delegation for Belarusian democratic forces in 2024. That's quite groundbreaking.
That sounds like real progress, institutional recognition.
It is. It's a big symbolic step. But, and this is the crucial but, it immediately hits what the sources call this raw vulnerability.
How so? If PACE recognizes them, doesn't that carry weight?
It carries moral and political weight, but not necessarily legal force in the way state actions do. Take the new Belarus passport idea. They tried to create travel documents for exiles, but it stalled because ultimately those papers aren't recognized as legally valid by other countries without Belarus itself, the state, ratifying them.
So practical things like residency permits, bank accounts, they still depend on state-issued documents.
Exactly. Tens of thousands are at risk of losing legal status in the EU because their official passports expire and they can't renew them. It highlights the gap between symbolic support and actual state power.
And the Russian opposition faces similar hurdles. Yulia Navalnaya is a powerful global symbol meeting world leaders.
Immensely powerful symbol. She consults with Macron, Scholz, Trudeau. But Western governments see her and others as vital civil society voices, advocates for democracy, not as potential heads of an alternative government they can formally deal with. That PACE-E dialogue platform started in late 2025. It's a place to talk, but it doesn't give them the status of, say, the Belarusian delegation.
So it really boils down to this. Without verifiable support inside the country, which is incredibly hard to prove from exile, and without the legal backing of statehood,
their role inevitably shrinks. It becomes about advocacy, running independent media, supporting the diaspora. Critically important work, but it can't replace the state itself. And that forces us back to looking at the nature of that state.
Right. Which brings us to that third deepest level of analysis in our sources. These persistent, almost eternal Russian traits that make it so different from the European path, and why the current conflict feels so existential for Moscow.
Yes, connecting the dots here. The sources highlight four really persistent characteristics rooted deep in history. First, these Asiatic origins. The argument is, while early Kiev had Narsk connections, was part of a wider European dynamic, Muscovy was profoundly shaped by the Mongol invasion, the Tatar yoke.
How so, specifically?
Moscow essentially rose to prominence, acting as the tax collector, the agent, for the Mongol Khans. It absorbed much of that political culture. Absolute, top-down, indivisible power, a different concept of property, more state-controlled, and the total subjugation of the population, leading to serfdom.
So the claim is Moscow wasn't just influenced by the Mongols, it sort of became their political successor in that region, inheriting that model of absolute rule.
That's the core argument. Moscow is an heir to the Genghis Khan model of state power, not just a Slavic principality that threw off the yoke.
That's a powerful rereading of history.
It is. In contrast that with the original East Slavic heartland, Kiev, and the Dnieper region. It ended up part of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth for centuries, which fostered more pluralism, different ideas about rights and governance, a sort of seed of a different Russia, potentially.
And this historical divergence, you're saying, is why a democratic Ukraine is seen as such a threat by Moscow today.
Exactly, because a successful, democratic, East Slavic nation right next door fundamentally challenges the Muscovite narrative that only autocracy is possible for Russians. It proves another path existed and exists. That makes it an existential threat to their system.
Okay, so Asiatic origins is the first trait. What's the second?
Empire is raison d'être. Empire is the very reason for the state's existence. The speed of Muscovy's expansion was just stunning late 15th century. By the mid-17th, they'd reached the Pacific. Then Peter the Great comes along, shifts the capital to St. Petersburg, brings in westernized elites, but crucially conquers Ukraine. That's framed as the moment Muscovy fully becomes Russia, the empire.
And the argument is this constant focus on empire prevents Russia from developing as a normal nation state.
Yes. The empire requires dictatorship to hold it together, the sources argue. And therefore, losing the empire isn't just losing territory. It's seen as a threat to the existence of the state itself.
Which leads logically to the third trait, the vast bureaucracy and military focus.
Right. Peter the Great didn't just build an army. He built the state on a military model. That table of ranks, 14 levels, was essentially a substitute for a real civil society or aristocracy. Everything was geared towards serving the state, primarily its military needs. And this bred systemic corruption from the start.
These three things, autocracy, empire, bureaucracy, they seem locked together.
An iron triangle, as one source puts it. They reinforce each other.
And the corruption wasn't just a side effect. It became ingrained. I remember that quote from Gogol's play.
It is strictly forbidden not to accept bribes, according to rank. From the Government Inspector, 1837. It captures perfectly how corruption wasn't seen as a flaw in the system. It was the system. Formalized. Expected.
Chilling. Okay, the fourth trait.
Political culture and mentality. Because Russia largely missed out on the foundational European experiences, the Renaissance, the Reformation, the Enlightenment, liberalism, a huge gap developed between the absolute power at the top and an atomized, disconnected population below.
Leading to that sort of passive acceptance we sometimes see.
Exactly. The sources describe the traditional Russian social contract almost cynically. The authorities pretend to care for the people, and the people pretend to respect the authorities. It fosters indifference, a sense that you can't influence the state anyway. Which helps explain, perhaps, why leaders known for brutality in service of the empire, like Ivan the Terrible or Stalin, can still poll surprisingly well. There's kind of fatalistic acceptance of strong, even harsh, rule.
So looking back, have there ever been moments when this iron triangle seemed breakable?
Historically, the sources argue, serious attempts at change have only really followed major military defeats. Think 1905 after the Russo-Japanese War, 1917 after World War I, or the stresses leading to the collapse of the USSR in the 1980s after the Cold War loss.
But even perestroika in the 80s didn't fundamentally change things.
It tried, but it ultimately failed to dismantle the old structures, especially the security services, which remained dominant. And crucially, there was no real reckoning with the imperial autocratic past. As one historian put it, history reached a turning point, but Russia failed to turn. The old patterns reasserted themselves.
So bringing all these threads together, what we're seeing today, the weaponization of the church, the struggles of the opposition, it's all playing out against this backdrop of deeply rooted autocratic imperial structures.
Precisely. The tragedy is seeing institutions like the ROC captured and deployed as tools of a state still operating on centuries-old assumptions about power and empire. The Kremlin's political warfare isn't new, it's just wearing different clothes now, sometimes literally vestments, and it's directly targeting any democratic alternatives, especially in the Slavic world.
For those of us watching, what are the takeaways? How do we counter this?
Well, on a practical level, demanding transparency about church funding, exposing these influence networks, that's crucial. Understanding the real legal limitations of exile opposition while still supporting their advocacy work is also important. But fundamentally, it requires acknowledging the sheer depth of these historical roots, this belief that empire and autocracy are necessary for Russia's survival.
Which leaves us with a pretty stark final thought, doesn't it? If history suggests that real change, a break from this imperial cycle, has only ever followed major military setbacks.
It does raise a difficult question for you, the listener, to ponder. Given that consistent historical pattern, what outcome short of a decisive military defeat could genuinely force Russia to confront its imperial past and maybe, just maybe, pave the way for lasting democratic change?
A profound question indeed, and one rooted firmly in the analyses we've explored today.
It's been essential to dig into these sources. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.
Absolutely. A vital discussion.
Yeah.
Until next time.